This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Unmet needs in page turners.
Matt Orr.
Fantasy films of the aughts.
And the occultism of Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The click of a drama token, the thump of strong exception made to a situation posed by the GM, the crunch of Doritos and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into a gaming hut, where today in the gaming hut, Robin, there are only two players, and both of them, oddly enough, are wearing hats, which is wild. It is as though we are engaging in a bit of among our many hats while within the friendly confines of the gaming hut, and the specific hat being yours. Why don't you unburden the mystery for the listening audience?
Right. So Page Turners, my game of interpersonal drama for one player and one GM, is through layout and headed to the printers by the time you hear this. Might or might not actually be at the printers, and the full retail release will be early next year, but it's time to start banging the drum for it. This includes scenarios by myself and by Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman. And I thought we would unpack a little bit about how the game works. And conveniently enough, the format of one player and one GM works great for a podcast with two co-hosts. So I thought we would provide an example of how certain things work. You may be familiar with Hill Folk and its game engine drama system and the way that scenes unfold, and there is a conflict between the characters and a currencies exchange between them. And you may also be familiar with the way that during character generation, you establish your unmet needs toward other characters. In the case of drama system, other player characters. Well, here you still do that. And we're going to look at how that differs from Hill Folk in Page Turners, because the cast of other characters that you have dramatic relationships with is played entirely by the GM. This gives you, as it does in Gumshoe One-to-One, a much more intense experience. You are both on stage the whole time. You don't have a lot of time to react. And so while Hill Folk provides very loose guidelines for a heavily improvised style of play, because you have lots of time to think of what your next move will be when you call a scene, or you have time off to think about what your character wants and what they're going to do. While here, since the GM plays all the characters and the player is in every single scene, it gives you a much more detailed set of ideas and character sketches and situations, which you then radically deviate from one instance to the next, but still have a detailed grounding in whatever the scenario is. So you get a player pack, and that includes information on the protagonist. Sometimes you get to choose your protagonist. And Ken, let's rope you in here, because we're going to go through the beacon, which is my sort of Fitzgerald pastiche scenario. And in the beacon, you have a choice between two different characters who can be the protagonist, and the one who is not chosen becomes an important Game Master character. So, Ken, you have a choice between Steve Stark and Delia Stark. You've been provided with the player's guide already, so you've had a chance to read them over. So tell me about which character you have chosen as the protagonist.
I feel like it's true to Fitzgerald. If the male character is the one with depth and the female character is the one who's a symbol. So I think I will be the male character, Steve Stark.
So Steve Stark, as is presented in the player guide, he's 26. He's kind of washed up in Westport, Connecticut, and he's married to an increasingly unhappy woman, Delia. He is a son of a business failure and an alcoholic dad, and instead he's looked all his life for his ambitions of success and making it in America to his ancestor, John Stark, the Revolutionary War general and so-called hero of Bennington, who coined the New Hampshire motto, live free or die. So he's always wanted to make it. He's wanted to be John Stark, not his dad. So hard work at prep school got him into Princeton. He still faced the snubs of his high-hatted rich classmates, and he fell for a rich girl. And the rich girl liked him. The rich girl's dad didn't. He went into the army, thought he could get into World War I and distinguish himself there. But unfortunately, he wound up never leaving the home front. But while in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, he met Delia. And it took him a while to let go of the previous rich girlfriend, but he finally... when she finally married, he and Delia eloped, and so they headed to the Big Apple. He washed out of the advertising business. He washed out of his own public relations firm. He moved to Westport, Connecticut to accept a job as a clerk in his Uncle John's furniture manufacturing business, and he hasn't told Delia about this, but he walked out. He quit a week ago. They live in a cottage next to a big mansion, and in the big mansion dwells Henry Huck Stanton, a glamorous millionaire who throws big parties. They haven't met him yet, but the sound of those parties, the sound of the joy and the wealth radiating from that manor have definitely pressed themselves on Steve. So this is the point where we go through the cast of characters, and you, playing Steve, will define what it is you want from all of them that each of them is unable to provide. And the thing that is different from the way that this works in drama system is that you have to work a little harder to make sure that those things are varied from one another, because you're picking all of them in a row. So it's just, right. If you say, I would like them to realize my ambitions, and say that seven times, that's less interesting. You have to find possibly all things that refer to that, but refer to that in different ways. So, Ken, your character Steve, the first character for whom you have to define an unmet need, is the one character that you've actually met so far, and that is Delia. So what is it that you need from Delia that you are not getting?
I'm not sure that Steve is self-aware enough to know that he's not getting true love from Delia. I think Steve has been sort of the only thing in his life that's worked on easy mode is girls. And I don't think that Steve knows that he isn't getting true love from Delia, though that would be his unmet need. So what he needs is the love of a good woman. Sadly, he doesn't have any good women around, but he does have Delia, his wife, so he should be trying to make that work. But he doesn't know it because he's too in his own head and too messed up by his own family's past.
Right. And for those who choose to play Delia, she definitely has her own ambitions. The objective is not to make her a cipher character, as she might be in Fitzgerald, but to make her the character who sees the opportunities to grab things that she has not been able to grab that Steve has not given her. And then you would go through. And so she has a backstory where she is chafed at the restrictions of her stuffy family and has always been the wild child and thought that the handsome Steve Stark was the best guy ever. And then has slowly realized that he's not that. And so the unmet need that you might determine for Steve, if you're playing Delia, is for him to shape up, for him to become the person she assumed he was when she first met him, or to get out of the way of her ambition. So you would have all sorts of different choices there. It is not always the case, but sometimes the case, and very much the case in The Beacon, that you, as the creator of your character, are determining relationships that haven't yet been established on stage. And this is what happens here. And so you, as Steve, don't yet know who the rest of the cast are. You meet them in the course of the scenario, but you, the player, know who you're going to have these unmet needs toward as they begin to show up. And the most obvious one is Henry Huck Stanton, the glamorous millionaire. He's a little older, a little rougher looking, but still good looking, party throwing occupant of the Beacon Hill Manor. And there's an enigma surrounding him. How exactly did he make his money? He's stinking rich, unlike a lot of rich people, unlike the rich people Steve has met before. He's willing to spend money, and not just spend money, but on a good time. Is his background, did he corner the market on Wall Street? Did he work in munitions? Is there something fishier going on? Ken, what does Steve want but can't immediately easily get when he meets Huck Stanton?
Huck is basically, he's too young to be the father figure type guy that Steve desperately needs. But the next best thing would be a sort of a patron and employer. Steve needs money, and Huck has money, and Huck also has the kind of ill-defined financial existence that drew Steve to New York in the first place. So Steve would like to be part of Huck's financial circle, but also be a sort of a trusted lieutenant of Huck. I feel like the desire for, you know, getting on Huck's good side is not necessarily about friendship with Huck, because he also knows that he needs financial support from Huck. So the contrast in there may canker at him, but he, you know, cottage gotta be rented, and Huck has money. So he might be thinking he can play Huck, or he might be thinking that Huck and he can strike up a genuine friendship, but still sort of a patron-client relationship.
So it's absolutely certain that you're going to meet Huck. He's the, other than your spouse in this scenario, is the central character, central supporting character. And the other characters you may or may not interact with much or at all. And so one of the options, as you find the way that your version of this story goes, and every time I've run The Beacon, it has gone quite differently. Some of these may be important, some of them may not. Sometimes you'll be establishing an unmet need that doesn't really come up naturally in the story. But that brings us to the rest of the cast. And the first one we're going to establish an unmet need for is Jane Delisle, who's Huck's right hand, the protective personal assistant slash person who may be secretly running everything in the manor, very buttoned down, conducts herself with an air of cool professionalism, stands back from the parties, but wields power behind the throne. What is it that you're going to possibly want from Jane Delisle that she won't immediately give you?
Well, I think that with Jane, Steve's sort of good-looking charm with women is going to hit one of its few roadblocks, because Jane does not necessarily assess men purely on their jawline. So he's going to need her approval to be Huck's lieutenant, but he has no idea how to do it without, you know, using his charm, and that is not enough. And so he is in the odd position where in an ideal world, he would not have anything to do with Jane, but he needs her approval, and he has to figure out how to get her approval in some, to him, mysterious new way.
Next, we come to Pat Mossy Colbeck. This is Huck's bodyguard. He's short, muscular. He's got close-cropped hair. He's got a red scar from what looks like a knife attack across the left side of his neck. And he projects a sort of menacing competence. And his mere existence as a figure at Beacon Hill underlines some of the rumors about possibly how Huck made his money. So what is it that Steve is going to want from Mossy that Mossy isn't going to immediately want to give him.
Physical respect. Clearly, Steve is going to need to establish that he's as good as Mossy. He, I think, knows that if he gets a job with Huck, it's going to overlap with Mossy's job. So Mossy needs to back off and know that Steve was in the army. Steve can take care of himself. He's not afraid of Mossy. He needs Mossy to give him physical respect and space.
So immediately, that's a very strong unmet need, one that contrasts sharply with every version of the Beacon I've run so far, and will undoubtedly, if we actually went through and played this, have a big impact on the way that it came out. Next, we come to one of the hangers-on on the party scene at Beacon Hill. Her name is Nell Westerberg. She's a willowy, bubbly, budding starlet. She's had a couple of roles out in Hollywood, and she's frequently seen, if not on Huck's arm, pretty close to Huck's arm, and word has it that she is encouraging Huck's latest ambitions, which is to become a producer out in Tinseltown. What would Steve need from Nell that she won't immediately give him?
I think that Steve would need Nell to like Delia. I feel like, again, Steve is good enough looking, and he's, you know, someone that Nell might be drawn to. I don't think he needs her physical approval or whatever, but I think that he knows that Delia is going to get mad if he's just hanging around this movie star all the time. So what he needs her to do is like Delia, so that best case, they become, you know, BFFs, and Delia can hang around with the glitzy lifestyle that she wants and leave Steve free to schmooze Huck. But worst case, at least, Delia won't be yelling at him for hanging around Nell Westerberg all the time. So in an ideal world, Nell and Delia become BFFs, and his path is clear to work Huck.
Now, next we come to a special character designation in Page Turners. This is something that is not found in a drama system where it is unnecessary, which is, of the various characters, there are a couple that are presented as possible confidants. The role of the confidant is, unlike all of the other characters, is not going to put you under significant pressure when you enter into a scene. So if you go to choose to talk to the confidant character, you will get support and advice. And it gives you a little break in the narrative where you're not constantly being squeezed by someone else emotionally, and have someone who has your desires at heart for some reason, and who's gives you a little bit of comfort and solace amid the drama, which otherwise becomes pretty intense. So you have a choice of two confidants. The one you do not choose as a confidant just becomes a regular Game Master character, toward which you also select an unmet need. You do not pick an unmet need toward the confidant, though, because they're the ones who meet your needs. You go to them for advice, they help you. If the GM thinks you really need a break, they come to you and give you advice. So your choices here are, first of all, Abbott Conant, who's an old money scion. He's a little bit older than Huck. He's got a pencil-thin mustache. He's suave. He's charming. He's observant. He's always at the parties. He's always at least four martinis in. And in the movie version of this, he might be played by Zachary Scott. He might be played by William Powell. But he's one of your two possible confidants. He's and what you often want in a confidant character is someone who is observant of the situation and of the other characters, because they can provide you advice on how to move forward toward whatever your goal is. The other possible confidant here is, as is our wont at Pelgrane, a real-life historical figure, Dorothy Parker. She's 29 years old. She's a magazine writer already, and she's been staying at Beacon Hill at Huck's invitation. And she's already one of the famous wits of the Algonquin Round Table. She seems to be possibly gathering material, possibly herself just resting up from the pressures of her life. And she also has a not exactly satisfying marriage. So, Ken, is it Abbott Conant who will become your confidant, or Dorothy Parker?
Now, every fiber of my Ken Heights being cries out to be buddies with Dorothy Parker. In my time machine travels, I am buddies with Dorothy Parker for sure. That said, Steve Stark I don't want to say that he's worthless, but he's pretty worthless. So he is not going to be a confidant of Dorothy Parker because he can't meet it. He's not up to scratch. He will be confidant with Abbott Conant, who is, he would never say it, you know, to himself. Even, I mean, Freud is big now, but Steve, you know, reads enough to get by in cocktail parties. So we might subconsciously, let's keep Freud in the mix, think of Abbot Conant as a bit of a father figure, but actually he gravitates to him because he's also his own idealized self-image. That he's the rebel, but he's the rebel with money. He can use the daywalker. He can move between worlds. And so he gravitates to Abbot Conant. And for whatever reason, Conant, you know, maybe, he reminds me of myself. Maybe this is a great way to wind up everyone with actual money and self-respect at this party, whatever it is. Maybe he's a Revolutionary War fan. And the only guy at the party who will talk to him about the Battle of Bennington is Steve. I don't know why Conant likes Steve, but he does. And they become confidants despite everything else.
One thing that distinguishes these choices already from the when I've run this or seen it run is that your authorial detachment from Steve is pretty high. And so that would be a very interesting thing to see played through. And also, I must say that everyone always picks Abbot Conant, no matter how clear the message that Dorothy Parker will, in fact, be your confidant and not give you a hard time. Somehow, everyone is still too intimidated to have her as a confidant, which is...
This is not an intimidation by me. It's an intimidation of Steve. Steve is intimidated.
Yes. Other players, I think, have also been intimidated. Right. But it's like you can have Magic Missile or Fireball, and everybody picks Magic Missile. But that means that Dorothy Parker is someone toward Steve has an unmet need, which should contrast with the other ones already established.
In sort of the, sketchy version of this, you might say, well, Steve wants to impress Dorothy Parker and he doesn't impress Dorothy Parker. So he just wants to impress her with his skill or with his worthiness to be, you know, in some other respect. And maybe that's still it. But Dorothy Parker, of course, famously has terrible taste in men. She just awful, awful romantic life, just a nightmare. So I feel like what happens is that Dorothy Parker finds herself attracted to Steve. Steve is completely unworthy of this attraction, as are most of the people Dorothy Parker was attracted to. And so Steve thinks he's in, you know, sort of familiar territory, and he wants to use Dorothy Parker for influence in New York because he knows that she's a big wheel in New York. And surely if she puts in a good word for him at the New Yorker, he can come back to New York in triumph and get a good job. Maybe at the New Yorker, he's always fancied himself to be a writer. He's lived, but maybe as an ad guy with one of the agencies that the owner of the New Yorker is friends with. So he wants to use Dorothy Parker's contacts to get back to New York and win at the game that he washed out of in the first round or the first inning. And, you know, he certainly doesn't, you know, respect Dorothy on any real level, but he knows that she's, you know, wired in, and he knows to use that or to try to use that.
And finally, there's a bit of a wild card character, Ned Reuter. He's the odd job man, the handyman who sort of shambles around the estate, looking resentful and casting a scornful eye at everyone, including, strangely enough, Huck. What is the unmet need that Steve has toward Ned Reuter?
Now, when I read the setup, it says I can ignore one of the NPCs.
Yes.
Well, that is who Steve ignores. Ned is the help. The last thing Steve needs is to be seen talking to the help on a level of equality. That would ruin it. First of all, it would be bad for Steve's self-image. Second of all, he thinks that it would make Huck look down on him and think of him as a servant instead of a trusted lieutenant. And lastly, Steve is not actually, you know, a big enough human being to want to talk to anyone who he doesn't want for something else. He does not have a sense of brotherhood. He has not learned the true lesson of his ancestor, John Stark, sadly. Maybe John Stark can appear as a ghost at the end and set him right. That'd be good. But either way, he's ignoring the handyman, no doubt to his eventual comeuppance.
Yes. And in fact, by specifying that you're ignoring him, you've established an unmet need, which is to be left alone by that guy who you want nothing to do with. And so that gives the game moderator something strong to play when he wants to bring in Ned, should Ned be needed. Because as I said, the story can go in all sorts of different directions. I could already tell that if we played this out, given your feelings about Steve, that it would go in a very different direction than every other time I've seen it. But anyway, that's how the unmet needs work. And it's not just that you don't have an interaction with other players and with every other player at the table and establish a bunch of different varied things, but you're creating the variants yourself. And so that is basically all that is involved in It's not a session zero because generally you run a single episode of Page Turners, but it's the zero portion before you launch into play and start calling scenes. Next week, we'll come back and talk a bit about scene calling in Page Turners and how that differs or doesn't from Hillfolk. And we're going to stick with Steve for next week. So we won't play out full scenes, but we'll discuss how you would go about calling them and what a series of scenes might be. But until then, we are going to earn a drama token by giving in to the desire of this commercial to give it a listen.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
a childhood haunted by strife and a shadowy being,
Deceit and Survival on the spaceship Earth Again,
a stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
the screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws,
the Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
a love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens,
behind the music drama in the LA punk scene,
the arrival of a telepathic stranger on a spacebound way station,
tragic love between a vampire and a mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways. Welcome once again to Ken and or Robin Talk with Someone Else. And today, that's the someone else, Matt Orr of Wet Ink Games, and we're talking in Indianapolis in the Embassy Suites, which explains the weird echoes, the strange thumping in the walls, the odd strangled scream that you may hear. That's all because we're here at Gen Con. And
it's the ambiance.
The ambiance, exactly. And Matt, I've seen you, I think we were talking about this before we hit record, at show after show, a lot of Origins, and I don't think I knew you were from Louisville.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and one of the great mid-sized American cities, quite frankly.
Now that I've been to all these other bigger cities to go to all these cons, I agree. It's nice to come back to nice mid-sized.
I love going to Louisville. It's one of my favorite things. I'm heartsick that they're not doing Gamma at Louisville. It was like, oh, professional reason to go to Louisville. How great is this?
Well, we get 2 more years.
Like, yeah, just a little bit. Anyway, enough about my sadness and bourbon. Let's talk about, you're a designer / publisher.
Yeah.
Did you start Wet Ink to publish Matt Orr games? Did you start Wet Ink because no one else was making games look actually attractive and you thought, surely we should have actually attractive games that people want to pick up and won't be embarrassed to have on their shelves?
So I'm going to say yes to both halves of those.
Okay.
With the caveat that, like, basically everything that I've done as Wet Ink has been with my business partner, Brandon Ayton. And so, yes, we wrote books together as a writing team for other companies.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had an idea that was too wild for anyone else.
Right.
And so we decided, like, oh, if we want it to happen, how hard can it be?
Right.
You get money from Kickstarter, you ask your friends to draw you a cover, like, and then you just write a book, you know, and put it out. And
simple, easy peasy.
We did do it as sort of a way to get out an idea that was sort of, we didn't think anyone else would take it as a pitch, right?
Right.
So we did it ourselves. And that was Wild Skies, our first product, which was a diesel punk anthropomorphic sky pirates in 1930s Europe.
Who doesn't love it, right?
Many, many people do not love it.
Story sells itself, as far as I'm concerned. You play a cool fox with goggles who's fighting Nazis. How is this wrong? How is this wrong? Tell me how this is wrong.
It was very dynamic setting. We made a system that shows our crunchy roots, playing a lot of... Brandon and I both were coming up on Palladium games, so we...
Oh, wow.
So we have, like, it's a percentile-based system in what we call in Wild Skies. But we added some little details to it, and then basically our system we use now, which most of our games...
The One Plus.
Plus One.
Plus One,
It's just the details. So we added details to a percentile first, and then took just the details, and that's the system for most of our other games.
Classic design. Designed by subtraction.
In this case, yes.
And then I think that... Maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the biggest Matt Orr game that you guys do is Never Going Home, the World War One occult horror game?
That has been, for many years, our sort of flagship game, with the inspired by Charlie Ferguson Avery's art, and then we were like, Charlie, this is amazing, well, let us make a game of it. And so then Brandon and I put together that sort of just the details version of what I was just talking about, and that's what we call Plus One, uses D6 dice pool. And because it was a World War One setting, we didn't want weird dice in the World War One setting. We wanted standard D6s and standard playing cards as a symbol.
We're in the trenches doing this.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And so we did that game, and that has been successful enough 3 times on crowdfunding that there's now 10 books for that game. And, you know, we're thinking in the future of, like, what will the 10th year anniversary edition, where you can get it all in one giant...
Exactly, the omnibus deluxe.
Yeah.
Now, with working with an artist like that, did he have a story behind his art? Was it just, this is a bunch of great thematically connected art, but he didn't have a world built? How much of this is a collaboration with him, and how much is just... He'd done this sort of great evocative stuff that you said there has to be some sort of, monster game in it.
We had that conversation, and Charlie did have, like, some notes about, like, what he might do with it, with what he would put in the setting, and he had sort of names for the different factions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it was not necessarily, like, a difficult negotiation, but, like, it was a conversation about, like, do we want to start with this, and then you'll be, like, part owner of this thing. He's like, I'd really just like to license the art and keep the stuff that I've already developed as my stuff, and then you can do whatever you want with the art.
Well, that's so excellent in a lot of ways.
So we have the art for the original set of however many 30 or so drawings that were the original set that we were inspired by, and then we're like, and of course we'll need you to do like 150 more in the same style over the course of the 10 books. Yeah. So at this point, the art is not coming from his brain in the same way, because I'm sending him, like, historical references and stuff like that. I'm like, this guy, we want this guy.
You need a Turkish submarine that's full of moray eels or something.
We've had influence on what he's drawn, but, like, definitely it's always come back to, like, just keep doing it in that same style. You hit it in one, keep doing it in that same style. So, but as far as, like, developing the world of Never Going Home as opposed to what he had originally done, that was, we kept it more historical. He was thinking of it more of like a fantasy version of things, and we were like, no, it's our world, but it's been corrupted.
So, or as I like to call it, the correct answer.
Sure.
Yeah. When you talked, as you said, this game has been basically driven by Kickstarter success. As a, what do I want to say, up-and-comer, up-to-mid-size game company?
I'd like to think that we're a small mid-tier company.
Small mid-tier?
Yeah.
Do you find that the sort of traditional half of sales, retail, distribution, the old three-act model, is that even relevant to you? Is it a rounding error? Are you entirely conventions, Kickstarter, and direct sales, and then the retail tier is nice if you can get it? Or do you guys, what do you do to drive retail? Because so often mid-tier companies run into this buzzsaw, and I want to know how someone who produces good games handles it.
I feel the buzzsaw a little bit. Like, what you said there about, like, that sort of, like, obviously we're funding the production of the books from crowdfunding and then selling direct at conventions to consumers who weren't backers, right? Funding production, we print more than the Kickstarter back to fulfillment, right? We print to a larger number. So then we have extras to sell to consumers at cons. I have a shop. I would like to buy 7 copies of everything at this table. And we're like, yes, please, let us carry it to your car for you. Oh, thank you. you know, that is sort of the bulk of what we are doing. But yeah, I if you've got advice, if you can give me an in at some of the bigger retailers, we would like to move up to that level, because getting up to, we've talked to some distributors that are like, talk to us when you can give us 20,000. And it's like, that's an impossible number. We're nowhere near that.
Yeah, we'll get in our time machine and go back to 1987 and get you those numbers right now.
But I mean, that's an extreme example, but like, they're definitely like, that mid-range is difficult. We're with consolidators like IPR who get us some of that, going to shows like Gamma, let us connect more with retailers. And we've made retail sales from the floor at Gamma to direct people. And we've got other conversations that we're having to get into more retail options or more distribution options so that we can be a more retail option, so that we can have more throughput, so that we can keep making games. Yeah. But it is sort of an ongoing challenge.
And this was really, I sadly have lured you into this conversation as a trap. I have no good advice. And I really wanted to know if someone who is clearly as good as you guys are at making good, beautiful, hooky, interesting games, and working with other great designers. I mean, you're not just a one-man shop.
No.
You did Zhongxi with Banana Chan, who is one of the great designers of our current era.
She's pretty unstoppable.
You've done, Try and Stop Her. Can't Be Done. You've done this stuff. You're doing everything else right. And my suspicion is, even for a company like you, the old model is fundamentally broken in such a way that you really are forced to sort of be out there on the cliff face, you know, digging for chalk.
We'll have the Huffington Horse 2 done soon.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we haven't figured it out yet.
You're right.
We would like to be better at that side of it, because we're always having conversations with peer companies, and mm-hmm. the pie chart of direct sales versus retail or distributor sales of like companies that are bigger than us is, you know, we're doing a quarter of their pie chart because
right.
they're doing all that other stuff.
Uh-huh.
And that's just a lot of conversations to have and those yeah. connections to make. And then, of course,
I mean, again, my advice has always just been, you know, make the Prito optimization system work for you. Find the 20% of retailers that have 80% of the sales. And, you know, hand sell them to the extent you can. And that's not an answer anyone wants to hear, but I'm afraid it's the answer that works.
Well, sure. And, yeah. you know, I just as soon as I get, we've been joking the whole way up here about Gen Con, like, oh, after Gen Con, we can do this. And after
right.
Gen Con,
after
we can
Gen
do that.
Con,
after
yeah.
Gen Con, we can do that.
And there's, yeah, and that's part of the trouble with being a publisher is that you've got so many basic tasks that have to be done.
I don't even know how to juggle, and I'm juggling all
right.
these things.
Keep the lights on, keep the product rolling out, keep the product to the level of quality that you guys do. That's not easy, and it's a lot of work, and it is always worth it. Just as a little PSA to the kids out there, there's a game you like, buy it directly from the publisher if you can.
Yeah.
You're making their life easier by roughly 70% on any given day. So think about that. I want to talk about your creative instincts as a designer. And one of the good things about being your own publisher is you can publish your insane ideas. Are there still things where Matt or publisher says, Matt or designer, don't do that, that's crazy, no one will do that? Are you getting rejection letters from yourself now?
So Brandon and I kind of are that for each other.
Right.
Where like,
you make him write your rejection letter.
I'll have a wild, crazy idea and Brandon will be like, no. And then sometimes Brandon has a wild, crazy idea and I'm like, no. So we kind of have to both agree that it's the right kind of crazy
each
idea.
Each one of you has to turn a key to launch the missile.
Yeah, we've got the missile keys in sync to on basically every project that we go forward on, we've both missile keyed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're both excited about it and working on it. He has the title business director, I have the title creative director, so like it takes both of those halves of us doing the business to make the stuff that we've done. You've been very complimentary of our products, and that does take both of us doing both halves of it.
You know, yeah, absolutely.
Working with all of the designers, you know, art direction and casting a team of writers and stuff like that, and then Brandon running all of the like conversations with the factory and stuff like that. So like, yeah, we kind of reject each other's ideas that are too far out there because...
Mm-hmm.
There are other projects, but then, you know, you can find my personal itch page and see some of the weirder stuff that I've done just on my own, which doesn't look nearly as good because I'm just doing it on my own.
You had a writer do it. Okay. But the sort of tame, middle-of-the-road product that you guys both approve includes now Garbage and Glory, game of raccoon dungeon delving, which again sells itself as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's another one of those projects that started with the art, like Never Going Home did. We saw Sam Brick, the artist, he had stickers, and it's been three origins ago that we saw these stickers. We're like, Sam, we don't know you. We can't make an RPG out of any of these amazing landscapes that you have, but these raccoons, is that a game? And he's like, no, it's not a game. I'm like, buy one of all the stickers. We're going to take them around and show them off to like all the people that are potentially going to write on this game. And then it was, like you said, easy to sell. Everybody that we showed the stickers to were like, yes, I will write that game. And so it's been a process to get that game finished because we ran into some scale challenges and we had to change writers at some point because of people coming on the project and then leaving the project and stuff like that. It's all normal production stuff.
Regular game design nightmare.
Regular game design. I wouldn't even call it a nightmare. It's just the process. It takes a lot of...
That's right. Normalize the nightmare. That's the motto.
Yeah. I mean, nobody does this for very long without getting used to that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason I'm not a publisher.
But as we developed it, the writers for there, myself, Josh Heek, Dieter Zimmerman, and Michelle Lee, and the four of us together wrote different parts, and everybody kind of was bringing their stuff together, and this is the creative director part of what I do, is like, after all the other pieces were written, then I had to go back and massage everything into one cohesive whole.
Right. And develop it into a cohesive game with a cohesive vision.
And a lot of the things that got contributed were that, like, okay, if we're doing like a dungeon crawl thing, the sewers are the dungeon and the raccoons are the heroes, and the ogres are these like ununderstandable gigantic monstrosities who built the world that we live in and yet they've abandoned it and filled it with trash and stuff like that. That all starts to sound very like old schooly, and so there was a lot of like, okay, the magic needs to be weirder because like this isn't weird enough for that kind of a world.
And right.
The monsters need to be more dangerous because these monsters aren't dangerous or enough yet for this sort of weird, almost appendix any kind of like tone that ended up coming through the book.
Sort of going from a tribute band to a next band in the musical style.
It's like, you know, when people talk about post-rock or whatever.
Right,
it's like, like when people have listened to enough rock and roll, they go back and listen to blues and then make rock and roll again.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, that kind of ended up in the element of it. So it's, I think it's, we say it's all ages. It is very fun. It has great art by Sam Brick, but then it's also got like this sort of, you know, you're up against a world that you can't understand. The world was made by monsters, and you're here, and you've got to do the best you can in it. And that feels very like old-school role-playing.
So cosmic horror, dungeon-delving raccoons.
Yeah.
A concept as old as the hills and as fresh as today. But again, this is sort of the example of what I think, to the extent there is a Wet Ink brand, is kind of the Wet Ink brand. Is half of you is like, why didn't I think of that? Mm-hmm. And the other half of you is like, I could never have thought of that. This is the product of a singular, I don't want to say singular, because as you say, you work very closely with the artist, and it's the product of a specific artistic vision in a way that many other games are, I don't want this to sound mean to other games, but they're content to be like the next good Cthulhu game, or the next good dungeon game, or the next good whatever, which is hard enough to do, but the Wet Ink brand seems to be, but let's do it weirder and with better art and see if that works.
I mean, I think you've hit it really on the head there with that. Like, that is...
Well, I've been at your booth literally three times. I think I know what I'm talking about.
We do want to prioritize the art. And for those projects that started with an artist's vision, they're not limited by anything. They're not trying to meet anyone's expectations. So, like, they can draw the weirdest stuff. And then the book is a process, the game is a process of catching up with their vision. So that was the case of Never Going Home, and then Garbage and Glory. And some of our other games, the art didn't exist until we had the idea for the game, and then we're trying to find art that matches the writing or the tone or how we imagine it. And we're trying to push that same thing, but it can never work the same way as when you have like a singular artist doing something that isn't anything else other than this one piece of art.
Yeah, I find that any sort of game, you need a touchstone that you can always magnetize yourself back to. Yeah. Even if when I was doing Nice Black Agents, it's that middle fight in the middle Bourne movie is what I kept this is the game of that fight in that movie.
Yeah.
And then everything else is concentric circles around it.
Yeah, whatever your lodestones are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Again, we could talk forever about this stuff. I do want to make sure you, Wedding Games, obviously weddinggames.com.
Yeah, weddinggames.com.
Yeah. Following you specifically, you said you have an itch page.
I do. My personal itch page is called Alu Walking at Itch. That's A-L-O-O Walking at Itch.
If you're getting potatoes at an Indian restaurant, that's what it is, Alu Walking.
It's one of those things where when you're young and you come up with a cool online handle, and then you're stuck.
And then you're stuck with it forever. Yes.
You either abandon your youth, or you embrace the.
Or you wait for the social media site that you put it on to die, so that no one can ever find out that you were once Prince of Cairo.
Yeah.
The challenges of being a role playing game creator, role playing game company publisher, and then also I really want to just lightning fast hit the fact that you guys are also making board games because you don't have enough trouble yet.
Well, it seems like such a good idea. There's more board gamers than there are role players.
So yes.
We want to bigger our company. We talked about throughput and mm-hmm. like trying to keep the lights on, like you said. It makes sense to like, oh, we make board games too. Then if people are like, oh, well, I don't play board games, you're like, or people come into the booth and they're like, what is this? These are role-playing games. I don't play role-playing games. You're like, ah, well, then we'll let us direct your attention to these two games here at this end of the table that are board games. And that's sort of the idea. Also, Brandon and I both love board games.
Yeah.
So we decided to do some. So we've got one out, Zero Day War. It's been out since it came out at, actually, Game Hole Con was the last con it was available, or first con it was available at last year. But for this, new for this show, we have Herd, which is a game of dinosaur survival. You're playing a herd of dinosaurs, and you have a hand of prey cards, and those are weaker, smaller dinosaurs that you can throw into the face of the predators, and then it's a numbers-matching game, essentially. Right. The predator has 9, your herd has 6, you need to make up the difference somehow. Oh, look, here's a iguanodon that is a 4, so now you're a 10, you're ahead of the predators. The iguanodon gets eaten, but nobody in your herd is lost.
Right.
You know, so it's a game that has great art. Central, it's very sepia tone, outlined the dinosaurs by a real paleo artist. So it looks great, it's got a very evocative theme. But it looks a little bit like you're seeing into the past because it's got this sepia tone to everything. So, yeah, that's at our booth this year at Gen Con, which people hearing this won't be able to come to.
But they will be able to go to weddinggames.com and order it.
I hope so.
Yes, you hope so. All right. Well, Matt, like I said, we could talk forever. We've talked, you and me, for years. So
yeah.
We got no time to go back over that again. But I did want to thank you for coming on the podcast. And
yeah, I'm glad to finally be on your show.
Sharing just a little bit of the sort of, what do I want to say, the mind space behind making some stuff that I don't think it's possible if you're a person of sensibility to walk past your table and not have something happen to you.
Mm.
And that thing may be, I want no part of this, but I feel like if you're, you know, listening to this podcast, the odds are much better that it's, I have to be part of this.
Right.
And that's something that I think is not practiced enough in any art form, even in ours. So thanks for doing it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking note and chatting with me for years, and especially right now.
Right. Okay. Well, on this final note of commercial necessity, let us go to a necessary commercial and then perhaps to another segment.
In the Spiral.
4 scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
and must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Meet this podcast's financial needs alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Garrett Fitzgerald,
Hyperlexic,
Scott Stefanski,
Tim Morgan,
and Linda and Mike Schiffer.
The smell of the popcorn, the whir of the projector, which I feel may be whirring a little less as we move into the 21st century, it begins to have that digital nothing sound, but the cinema is still pretty well appointed. There's still seats together in the center row, in the center aisle, which is where we want to be, because we're settling in once more for the fantasy film essentials. And as I alluded to, we have turned the corner of the century. We are in 2001, and when we are talking fantasy essentials in 2001, we are talking about The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Rings specifically, but since Peter Jackson and New Line were good enough to release them seriatim, we don't have to break them up. Also, since the aughts are kind of a dead zone otherwise for fantasy, we don't really have to break them up. So let's talk, Robin, not just about The Fellowship, but about The Two Towers, and what the heck, about The Return of the King, 01, 02, 03, bang, 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 Lord of the Rings. What's to say, I personally know and cherish two deep lore Tolkien people who get big mad at the movies. I came to it, I guess, from the exactly perfect spot of knowing a great deal, but not caring a great deal about The Lord of the Rings. And so I got to see, you know, sort of a part of my mind's legendarium, but not at all the biggest part of my mind's legendarium, thrown up onto the screen in big Hollywood style by someone who clearly loved, although it is arguable, did not understand the material. And it produced a absolutely wonderful fantasy spectacle. For every little dumb bit that you say, oh, well, there are 100 great bits where you say, yes, and Oliphant, that rules.
Yes, if you asked me for the coolest unnecessary moment, the Oliphant would also have featured in that as well. And what I think you're talking about when you say that certain lovers of Tolkien dislike it, what they wanted was a more naturalistic, real-seeming world. Peter Jackson's sensibility is more cartoony than that. This is a big, big gestured contemporary Hollywood blockbuster or New Zealand blockbuster, whatever you want to look at. But it's in that aesthetic mold. And indeed, the secret weapon, though, is the performances. It's hard to, I think, even if you don't like the movie, I think all but the most avid complainer accepts that Elijah Wood is great as Frodo and Ian McKellen is a fabulous Gandalf and Viggo Mortensen is a great Aragorn and that Sean Astin provides the necessary heart of the epic as Sam and that the various other characters, possibly with the exception of the dwarfs. I guess it varies depending on how much prosthetics you've got on for the people, for the detractors. But that this absolutely is, at least as far as the apex of what we immediately think of when we think of fantasy, which is elves and swords, this is still the cinematic apex of that in terms of its execution, its impact, not only becoming a giant hit, but also, you know, finally winning the Oscars for the third film. It does introduce a few things that later in other blockbuster films become a bit tiring, like the many ending syndrome. But overall, it's, I think, impossible to argue with this. It's shocking to me to think that next year is going to be the 25th anniversary of the first of those films. And it is also, I've looked ahead and done my homework on the fantasy films up until the current day, and this casts such a shadow that it's both the apex of the genre and arguably also kind of destroyed the genre. We must say, without putting it in the fantasy essentials category, that Harry Potter is happening at the same time. That also has a giant cultural footprint, arguably sucks up even more oxygen for the genre for its competitors, and also possibly has even more influence on the way that people come along and try to compete with that or copy it or repeat it. So consequently, once we get to 03, we're going to have a couple more titles, and then there's going to be a vast dead zone, not necessarily of fantasy movies coming out, but of fantasy movies that we want to celebrate, because we are now entering possibly the longest period of Hollywood history, the late decadent blockbuster phase, and a lot of films that come out and fill this category are would-be franchises, and begin to have all of the flaws of the giant CGI epic. But as those go, The Lord of the Rings is the one that does it right and arguably casts a flaming eye of doom over the entire rest of the genre. But in 03, there's another big film of which you could say many of those things, and I know you're a fan of, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl by Gore Verbinski. Why don't you sing those praises in appropriately piratical manner?
Yeah, Pirates of the Caribbean is one of the movies that I went to on the assumption that it would be bad, but I love pirate movies. So I thought, what the heck? I went. Gore Verbinski, previously in my radar, had done the nearly impossible task of making a good Hollywood remake of Ringu. The Ring is actually really good and really scary and has Hollywood virtues in place of the sort of Japanese film virtues of the original, but they still hit and they still work. So I didn't think that it was, you know, that Gore Verbinski couldn't make a good pirate movie, but what I did not believe was that anyone in this year of our Lord 2003 could make a great pirate movie, which is what he did. The story is, of course, of young Will Turner, who's a blacksmith's son who is accidentally basically forced into piracy. Keira Knightley is the love interest, the aristocratic Elizabeth Swan, and they are caught up in the toils of Jack Sparrow, drunken reprobate and bad pirate played by Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp claims he was basically channeling Keith Richards to play him. There's a lot of Bugs Bunny also in Jack Sparrow, as it happens. Both great role models, though perhaps not great role models in life. And of course, Jeffrey Rush doing his job throughout the whole turn of the century period of being the grown-up in the room and chewing as much scenery as people will allow him to do as Barbossa, the villain. And we also have a nice sort of a turn by Jonathan Pryce as Elizabeth's father, who is sort of the stuck-up orthodoxy that pirates hate. So that works out really well. And Kira even has a Baxter played by British drip Jack Davenport. It's kind of an ideal type of types. They all go together. The pirate action is well filmed. It's good. It's great naval action. It's a fun story. There's supernatural stuff in it that all sort of makes sense. There is a curse and a magic compass and ghost pirates and skeletons running around with swords. Ray Harryhausen looked down on this movie from heaven and said, I would have done it a little different, but you know what? This is good.
Right. And since Ray Harryhausen did a voice in the next movie we're going to talk to, he may not have looked down at it from heaven.
Well, he when you're in heaven, you can watch Pirates of the Caribbean as much as you'd like. It's one of the perks
right.
You're
Ray Harryhausen. He may also be watching it in heaven now.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm watching it in Chicago now, which is almost the same thing. But,
right.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing about that is not only that this is a modernized pirate movie, which notably modernizes the genre by nerd-trupping it, by adding the Walking Dead, but it's an adaptation of a theme park ride.
Yeah.
Which, speaking of terrible precedents, that Gore Verbinski did it right once.
Yes.
Again, this may also be responsible for the vast wreckage that follows. But It is one of those things that, like The Mummy, which we recently talked about, that harkens back to the great fun Hollywood movies of the past, particularly the Errol Flynn pirate movies, and does a darn good job of it. Much earlier, I mentioned that there were two great Santa Claus movies. And first one, of course, is Miracle on 34th Street. But in 2003, the Pantheon expands to two with Jon Favreau's Elf, which stars Will Ferrell as Buddy, the human who, through a set of circumstances, was raised as an elf at the North Pole and comes to New York City to meet up with the person he identifies as his dad, the crusty rich guy, James Caan, therefore adding, an element of screwball comedy to a Christmas fantasy. Zooey Deschanel is magical in her role as the girl that Buddy falls for. There's great little character bits by Ed Asner as an irascible Santa, Bob Newhart as the head of the elves. It actually has the saving Christmas sequence at the end is rousing and thrilling and fun and well-staged, which otherwise never happens in this overridden genre. And it's a delight from start to finish. A great Christmas movie has to be especially good because you wind up watching it a lot more than other films.
Uh-huh.
And it's just one of those magical combinations of actor and premise and brilliantly executed by Jon Favreau. It's an indisputable eggnog classic.
And absolutely a laugh riot. If we were doing a comedy essentials, it would also be on that. It is, you know, Will Ferrell had a real good run of great movies. I'm not sure this is quite as funny as Anchorman, but it is in the mix with Anchorman. His performance is absolutely necessary. It holds the film together. And his performance, you know, of course, is impossible for anyone who is a less gifted comic than Will Ferrell to pull off. And yet he does it. You know, Bob Newhart, you know, showing up as the dad elf, as Papa Elf, is, you know, one of the great sort of passing of the torches, I guess, in terms of, well, comedy can stop being literate. Here you go, Will Ferrell. But it is a heart tugging moment in and of itself. And then, as you say, it does Christmas right, which most Christmas movies, you know, they coast as opposed to carry. And yeah, there's not enough good things you can say about Elf because it is virtually a perfect Christmas comedy and virtually a perfect comedy.
And then we come to The Vast Wasteland. There's still lots of fantasy films being produced and some of them become hits. The Harry Potter thing continues. There's one installment of Harry Potter called Harry Potter and the Inexplicably Good Alfonso Cuarón movie that's yeah, worth looking at. And in 08 is when the MCU starts with Iron Man, which is not a fantasy film. And even if it was, we're leaving superheroes out. The ascendance of the superhero is why that takes up a bunch of oxygen and the attention of a bunch of CGI studios and moves things away from straight up non-superhero fantasy. And so all of a sudden, and we've looked ahead, there's we're going to be able to wrap this series up pretty quick.
Yeah.
And it takes another 6 years for something that I feel is worth mentioning, which is Where the Wild Things Are from 2009. Spike Jones, who already got on the list with Being John Malkovich, does one of the most magical kids movies ever. And speaking of impossible tasks, it's a successful adaptation of the 1963 Maurice Sendak book, successfully adapting any picture book to a feature film. Unbelievable feat. He wrote the screenplay with Dave Eggers, but he's absolutely referring to Maurice Sendak, but also at the same time, creating his own very distinctive mood. You have to have a perfect child actor for this. Max Records does an amazing job as Max. Catherine Keener is great as his mother, but the voice talents for the various creatures are amazingly well chosen. There's something very soulful about James Gandolfini as Carol, the lead wild thing. Lauren Ambrose is in there as a maternal creature. Catherine O'Hara is Judith, who says she's a kind of a downer, which is a great line for the grown-ups to smile at. And there's Forrest Whitaker as Judith's sweet, mild, lumbering boyfriend. It's a mood piece that succeeds both as a work of art for adults and as a beautiful dream for kids. And it throughout is just astounding that it works. Who could possibly believe that that works?
Yeah, I mean, I watched it at the time. I enjoyed it very much at the time. I have not gone back to revisit it in, you know, video or even in my mind that much, but you're not wrong. It is seemingly an impossible task. I think, you know, in 2009, I was a big Spike Jones fan, still am, I guess. And so it was more like, you know, you see Mike Trout hit a home run. You're like, well, there you go. That's what he does. As opposed to, oh, right. It's very hard to hit a home run. I forgot. So in a way, I think Jones may have, you know, suffered in my estimation from all of his previous success, because I agree, this was a very tough movie to do well. It's just that maybe I was not counting in the degree of difficulty in my own appreciation of it.
Right. And also, neither of us have kids. We might have a very different list of fantasy films, because we'd be defining them by, does this stand up to the 50th watch, right? Is my child obsessed with it?
Right. Or did my kid hate it, which would be another
criteria. But speaking of a kid's film that you are definitely an advocate of, you've praised the other two parts of this 4-to-5-part trilogy. And now we come to Toy Story 3 from 2010, directed by Lee Unkrich.
Yeah, this is the climax of the story. The first story is the story of childhood, and the second story is the story of bad adulthood, broken adulthood. And now we have the story of the toys next phase, as Andy is going to college. He maybe doesn't need his toys anymore. The toys are being bagged up to put in the attic, but they accidentally go to a daycare center, and everyone thinks, goodness, what a happy ending. Now they can play with kids and it'll be fun. And what a good way to end the cycle. And then you look at your watch, you say, oh, this was just the first act. And sure enough, the daycare center is a prison. We're suddenly in a prison movie. And the gang of toys, led by a Lotsa Huggin' Bear, Ned Beatty, that sort of are the bosses of the daycare toy center, they don't want to be playing with the kindergartners because that's a death sentence. So they send the new meat in, and it's sort of a great dynamic there. We have another, you know, within Toy Story love story as Barbie finally meets Ken. Michael Keaton, of course, is Ken. The, you know, you have to spend $1 billion to be a better Ken than Michael Keaton, it turns out. And the story then is, you know, can the toys survive? Can they come back? Will Andy come back to save them? And then how do we take what looked like our happy ending and turn it into a real happy ending? And the trilogy concludes, as far as I'm concerned, with that. There are other movies in the sequence, as you cruelly allude to, but I don't have to pay attention to them any more than I do other Star Trek series or other Star Wars movies after Return of the Jedi. So there we are. Toy Story 3 completes the cycle in triumphantly. Once more, Randy Newman does the soundtrack, absolutely kills it. The movie made $1 billion because everyone else loved it, just like me. It's a normie opinion, but it turns out, as with many normie opinions, to be the right one.
Well, if Toy Story 3 actually had no follow-ups, that's different from Cinema Hut Fantasy Essentials, because there'll be another follow-up next week as we rocket through the rest of cinematic history. But we're now going to move from that to this. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to pause on the landing and wave to the King of the Fire Salamanders, who's there on a portrait on the wall, but it's a magical portrait, so he waves on back. And then we're going to swing on in to the Edwardian parlor of the Consulting Occultist, where beloved patron backer Jason Thompson wishes to consult the occultist about the esoteric side of filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky. This, I think, comes into the context of another question that Jason posed about Alejandro Jodorowsky, which we will get to as you launch into his narrative. So what is in your occult dossier today?
Today, Jodorowsky, who is still with us, you know, in his 90s, born in 1929 in Chile to Ukrainian Jewish immigrants. His father was a shopkeeper, but he was alienated not just from his parents in standard arty style, but with everyone he met in Chile, because they were all mean to him. He was then forcibly moved to Santiago by his folks, where a different bunch of Chileans were mean to him. He went to Santiago University, studied philosophy and art and psychology, dropped out to do mime. That was his art form of choice. Founded a mime theater troupe in 1947 that blew up in Chile, but he recognized there was only so far you could take being Chile's greatest mime impresario. So he moved to France, studies at the Sorbonne, and joins Marcel Marceau's mime troupe. In between mime tours with Marcel Marceau, which take him all over the world, he does theater, directs the comeback vehicle for Maurice Chevalier, who had been accused of being a Vichy collaborator and was an unperson in France, but Jodorowsky helped restore his career. In 1957, he makes his first film, which is a short called The Severed Heads, based on a Thomas Mann story. That film was then lost for 50 years. People thought that it was gone, but 2006, it turned up in an attic. One of the actresses had stolen the work print. He moves to Mexico in 1960, where he meets Leonora Carrington, the surrealist artist. She is one of the people that inspires him to get into the tarot. He had previously encountered the tarot when he was a poor kid in Santiago. And then Leonora Carrington tells him that it's vital and important, shows him his first Rider-Waite deck. He's taken by it. He visits André Breton in Paris. After that, shows him his Rider-Waite deck, and Breton says, "Ha, the tarot is nothing, and go away, I hate you."
Yes, that highlights the differences between Carrington and Breton. So yeah. It is interesting that Jodorowsky is brought into esoteric thought through surrealism.
Yeah. So in 1962, he's sort of bi-national between Paris and Mexico City. He founds the Panic Movement. It's a performance art collective. You could call what they do theater, in that they put on performances, but it's performance art as we understand it now. The Panic Movement is named after the god Pan. It is devoted to absurdism and chaos. And of course, it's full of shocking the bourgeoisie sorts of stuff. This is not new in 1962, nor is it new in 1982 when it's punk, but it's the same shock the bourgeois vibe that Voltaire got into. So there we are. In Mexico, he also gets into Zen, studying it with Eho Takata, who is the first Zen teacher to be in Mexico. And also he starts doing a comic strip. His first comic strip is Anibal 5. That starts in 1966. And for the rest of his life, basically, he is active in and influenced by comics. And also possibly because he is now looking at pictorial art, again, very, very seriously, he starts a serious study of the tarot. He realizes that all the other tarots are wrong, that Waite, for example, changes the names and numbers of some of the cards. Crowley does even more. All your later tarot scholars have been wrong. The true tarot is the Tarot of Marseille. And so he throws away, he says, 1,000 tarot decks and studies only the Tarot of Marseille. And for example, this is him, "I slept every night with a different card under my pillow or spent an entire day with one of them in my pocket. I rubbed my body with the cards. I spoke in their names, imagining the rhythm and tone of each of their voices. I visualized each figure naked, imagined its symbols covering the sky, completed the drawings that disappeared in the frame." So he is making that sort of his centerpiece. Tarot is not his only occult interest. He has gotten into Gurdjieff. He's a big Jungian. Oscar Ichazo, the Bolivian mystic slash guru slash charlatan, has invented slash stolen the Enneagram from Gurdjieff, which is a personality sort of typer with some mystic larding on it. And he gets into the Enneagram, and of course he gets into alchemy at the same time. And this is probably thanks to Jung and the argument that the tarot is secretly an alchemical journey. The Panic Movement produces a film called Fondo Idlis, 1968, that debuts at a Mexico film festival, and there's riots and screaming, and everyone hates it because it is very, you know, shocking to the bourgeois. And his sort of statement about
shocking the bourgeois isn't new, but there's always a new generation of bourgeois to be shocked. So that keeps renewing the cycle.
Right. There's always more bourgeois around to be shocked. It's like, you know, shearing the sheep. They keep coming back with new wool. One can't teach the unconscious to speak the language of reality. Reason needs to be taught to speak the language of dreams. And if there is a through line for his sort of filmic language, I think that's kind of it. He says that much later in the documentary Psychomagic, but I think it's a good summary. His next movie is an acid western called El Topo. He doesn't even try for the Mexico audience for that. He takes it to America, and it gets shown in a bunch of late night, you know, midnight movie type situations and art houses.
Right. This is right when the midnight movie phenomenon is beginning to take hold, and that El Topo and the next one he will do, The Holy Mountain, become staples of that.
Right.
And this is where we get to Jason's other question, which is, I can't believe you didn't include him in Fantasy Film Essentials. I don't really think of his stuff, first of all, as being fantasy per se, just as surreal things may have fantastical overlaps, but are doing something different than fantasy. This is more of a allegorical vision quest in both cases, and therefore, I don't think really a fantasy film. Also, I am not a huge Jodorowsky fan because I do not partake of the substances required to enjoy Jodorowsky.
Yeah, precisely. If I'd watched them on acid in the 70s, I might be a bigger fan. But as it is, I saw them clean and sober on my couch in the 2000s. And it's like, well, I see what he's doing. You know, I guess he did that okay, but I don't know if it was worth doing.
And he's doing it kind of slowly.
Yeah.
He does it slowly.
Yeah. He does do it slowly, no doubt. El Topo also is where he does publicity for the film by claiming that he legitimately straight up raped the lead lady. That in 1970 is seen as daring publicity. Now it is seen as extraordinarily bad and awful. If you watch El Topo, you don't see the rape on screen. So his argument that he filmed it to get the immediacy of the moment is weird, because he apparently, if he filmed it, he cut it. And then later on, when he is no longer quite so interested in shocking the bourgeois and is very interested in having the bourgeois invite him to film festivals, he said, no, that was just me lying. I never did that. Look at how many times the camera changes. I couldn't possibly have done that with all those people on set. And it's like, well, you might have done it in one shot that then you looked at and said, I don't think I'm going to put this in my movie, shock the bourgeois or not. But we don't know. So either he's a guy who rapes an actress or a guy who lies about raping an actress for attention. Either way, something of a black mark on the generally, I think, beloved Alejandro Jodorowsky. So there. Anyway, John Lennon loves El Topo, and he gets his multimedia production company, AppleCore, to fund Jodorowsky. They give him $1 million for his next movie, which is, as we've alluded, the alchemical shamanic quest movie, The Holy Mountain. And this is where you just take a wheelbarrow full of occult imagery and dump it in. And that's 1973. He refuses to make the story of O for Alan Klein of Apple. And so Alan Klein buries El Topo and Holy Mountain in rights issues and doesn't allow it to be screened basically after the mid 70s. So if you saw it illegally until about 2007 when it finally came out on a legitimate DVD.
Right. Well, I got to tell you, it was screened illegally constantly in Rep Cinemas in Toronto in the 80s.
Yes, I feel like it was screened illegally in Chicago, which is where I first saw Holy Mountain. And it was screened illegally, I'm sure, in many other places. But it was, you know, impossible to
strike new prints.
And in any other way monetize these two seminal, if not essential, films. So in 1975, the comic artist Mobius gets the rights to Dune, and he says, let's make Dune, Alejandro. And so they get together and start planning Dune. And there is a very engaging documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune that, if you want to watch it, tells you the story. I'm not going to go into it, but it is a disaster. It is doomed. It is never going to happen. It would have been 14 hours. Salvador Dali would have played the emperor. It would have been a nightmare. And so much delight. There's a sort of a book of the storyboard by Moebius that you can buy if you are really spendy. And that will tell you what it might have been. But he recycles a lot of that imagery, he and Moebius do, into The Incal, which is a science fiction comic series. And that runs for 9 years, 80 to 88, and spawns a prequel and two different versions of the sequel. Moebius says, I'm not doing that sequel. It's bad. So he gets another artist to do it. And then Moebius says, oh, all right, I'll do the sequel then. And so it sort of, you know, two versions of the sequel, but anyway, it keeps going. And then there's a lot of spin-offs from the Incal, including Metabarons, or Metabarons, as I used to pronounce it back in the day. So if you're a fan of the Metabarons, that comes out of Jodorowsky's comic book. He comes back to film with a slasher film called Santa Sangre, which is, I think, just mostly psychic. It's not super occulty. Returns to France in 1990 from Mexico. He basically sets himself up as a Gurdjieffian guru, doing psychomagical rituals for people. And he writes Psychomagic, which is a blending of magic, Gurdjieffian praxis, and Freudian psychotherapy. So basically, you identify a deep trauma, you do a magical ritual, which might be performance art, it might be massage, it might be Zen-style acupressure, and then that heals your trauma with magic. So hence the term psychomagic. It's like psychotherapy, except that it combines two nonsensical things instead of just one. So while he's in Paris, he also produces a new edition of the Tarot of Marseille, a restored edition. They go back, as they claim, at least, to the original hand-painted tarots before the printed ones started introducing shortcuts and monocolor and things like that. He works with Philippe Camoin, who is the heir to the bulldozed by the French government printing house that printed a bunch of the tarots of Marseille going back to the 1700s. So you can still get the Camoin deck or the Camoin Jodorowsky deck of Marseille if you want. And writes The Way of Tarot in 2004, in which he talks about the agony of realizing that his version of the tarot that he had slept with and rubbed on and everything else was incorrect, that there were more dice, for example, on the magician's table than in the version of the cards that he had, and it really messed him up. But
you just don't want to rub an incorrect tarot on yourself.
You just get a rash that way. The Way of Tarot, by the way, is a really good tarot book, and it is especially good because it is someone who has basically lived the tarot for 30 years, explaining their idiosyncratic way of doing tarot. There's still plenty of this is the right way to do tarot, but it's very much this is how I do tarot, this is how I make tarot work, and less of a sort of this is how the ancient Egyptian wisdom made tarot work, or this is how the tarot reveal a entirely different system of magic that I, Aleister Crowley, am trying to sell you. So it's a really good tarot book, and I do recommend it. He writes that with Marianne Costa, who began as his sort of, you know, intern and then rose to be his collaborator. He does a musical autobiopic, The Dance of Reality, in 2013, and a sequel autobiopic, taking him into his, you know, 20s, Endless Poetry. That's in 2016. I've seen neither of them. I don't know if they're any good. And he makes a documentary / ad for his Psychomagic stuff with Psychomagic, A Healing Art, in 2019. And that is where we leave Jodorowsky in Paris, making movies and showing up at film festivals to show the two movies that are actually the place that his reputation will rest, El Topo and Holy Mountain.
Yeah, Psychomagic is, you realize pretty quickly as you're stuck listening to a guy monologue about his esoteric shtick. And I think I lasted 20 minutes, maybe it was 15. It is not a compelling documentary or a compelling shtick, frankly. So, Jodorowsky parallels different eras. He really hits his stride in the 70s, but he's around doing weird esoteric things in the 60s, and therefore including his meeting with Leonora Carrington. And so you can merge some Dreamhounds with Fall of Delta Green and have him doing all sorts of things. You can go a little further, possibly after the Fall of Delta Green, for the real, for the El Topo and Holy Mountain years. And since he's still around today, you could have him or a fictional version of him show up with tarot secrets or other things that he didn't want to share with you about the Yellow King in This Is Normal Now. So you can portray him in many different periods.
Yeah, I think getting him to vampirism is a bit of an ask, although he is very, you know, young looking for someone in his 90s, but I don't think that there's a lot of crossover. I guess if I'd seen Santa Sangre more than once, I might be able to find some bloody imagery in it, but it's a relatively conventional slasher. So maybe, maybe not. You'd really have to be wanting something to sort of make it work. The occult aspects of Holy Mountain and El Topo, this actually, if you've got a very tolerant group of players, you know, the Holy Mountain makes a great sort of a, this is a weird grimoire thing, and we have to figure out what it is, and anything you want to take out of it is probably in there somewhere. So, again, kind of a tiresome slog of a watch, but It is certainly going to inform state-of-the-art Macedwan occultism in 1973, if that's a scene that you're either trying to evoke as something that happened deep in the past of your game or is happening in the contemporary present of your game.
Yeah, you can certainly use the films as a model for their visionary dream quest or their Bardo Theudal, and you might, you know, screen 3 minutes of Holy Mountain at the beginning of every session for many, many sessions. And yeah. Maybe that's
a long running campaign.
And then use that as the jumping off point for you're in this place and you're doing this. And now do something interesting in this environment. Well, the interesting thing that we're going to do in this podcast is finish it, but we're only finishing it so that we can do another one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/CanAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from fiscal Nazgul by joining such backers as...
Peter Nix.
Philip Masters,
Randy Ship,
Ryan Lassiter,
and Brian Thomas.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time, and once again, we will talk about stuff.